Well, greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, September 8th, 2025 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week, I'll start with the From the Editor column, and then the cover story will be next. Points of Progress is AWOL, so I will read Progress Watch. But Science and Nature is back, so I'll read that, then the Home Forum, and then finally the Monitor's View. So getting right into it, the From the Editor column is entitled, Bad News is Not the Norm. This is written by Cameron Pugh, who is a staff writer, and you can email him at pughc@csmonitor.com. And I got a note here. It says, the Monitor Weekly will be taking a break from the Points of Progress feature as Cameron Pugh moves on to a new assignment. So join us in cheering Cameron forward in this next step. And he writes, why do reporters only seem to write about bad news? It's a question many journalists have faced at some point in their career. When a trusted source asks a journalist friend of mine that question, she gave him an answer that has stuck with me. Newspapers tend to report on things that depart from the norm, she said. A store getting robbed, for example, is more unusual than a store not getting robbed, and thus captures the attention of news gatherers and readers. I see two truths in her words. First, the most relevant news of the day will sometimes be the most difficult to hear. Second, and perhaps more important, bad news is not the norm. If you look more broadly, by examining a longer stretch of time or by digging deeper, you'll often find light amid the darkness. I've tried to keep both of those truths in mind during my 2-year tenure as the lead writer of the Monitor's Points of Progress feature. Many tragedies have consumed the news since I started working at this section. Political polarization has sharpened. Devastating wars in Gaza, Ukraine, and Sudan have raged, and countries around the globe have slid closer to authoritarianism. For readers, that darkness can feel impenetrable. Yet every week, my editor, co-writer, and I managed to find pieces of good news from around the world. Although it sometimes felt like looking for a needle in a haystack, it was also gratifying to see how people march towards something better in ways both big and small. The progress we found countered not only the deluge of bad news, but also the entrenched narratives that cast developing countries as backwards and ignore the true spirit of their citizens. I've also learned harder truths about progress. It's contextual. Progress in one place is not necessarily progress in another. It doesn't march to a steady drumbeat and often involves taking 3 steps forward and 2 steps back. It's also full of caveats. A touching story in this issue of the Weekly, penned by Troy Aiden Simbejan, who also co-writes Points of Progress, highlights that dynamic well. His story traces 2 sides of a community-led effort to clean up excess garbage in Oakland, California, by examining both the caring people doing the work and the gap in city services that lets trash accumulate in the first place. Progress is there if you look for it. It marches on, messy, unsteady, and persistent. That remains an important part of any story, even if it doesn't always capture our attention. That was the From the Editor column this week written by Cameron Pugh, who's a staff writer, and it was entitled Bad News is Not the Norm. And now for the cover story. It is entitled Disconnection Becomes Opportunity. And in Las Vegas, a coalition of business owners and civic groups is working to reintegrate disconnected youth. This is written by Jackie Valley, who's a staff writer, and there is that paragraph here somewhere. Oh yeah, why we wrote this. A sizable number of teens and young adults in the U.S. are not in school, employed, or in job training. Civic leaders want to reconnect them to a path toward productive adulthood. From Las Vegas. Several miles from the glitzy Las Vegas Strip, tucked in a nondescript plaza, a restaurant is bursting with positive vibes. The dining room features cheerful yellow paint, a greenery wall, floral-inspired artwork, and a sign that says, Have a beautiful day. It's an intentional atmosphere for this eatery called the Blooming Bistro. The restaurant, in fact, is mission-driven. It considers itself a lifeline for adrift young people like Diego Ramos, who at this moment is juggling demands of the lunch crowd on this busy weekday afternoon. He clears plates from one table, refills water cups at another, and delivers fresh food and silverware to a third. "People struggle in life. People have hard times," says Samantha Steele, co-founder of the Blooming Bistro, which opened this spring. "I want people to feel hope and light when they come in here." A few months ago, this job wasn't on Mr. Ramos's radar. No job was. The 21-year-old grew up liking music and basketball, kid stuff, as he calls it, before getting swept up in gangs, drugs, and fights. He was arrested as a teen and kicked out of school. "It just got to a point where that was the only thing I knew because that's what everyone around me was doing," he says. When he moved to Las Vegas during his senior year of high school, that disrupted his education journey too. His mother heard about the opportunities at the Blooming Bistro and its mission to provide young adults from challenging backgrounds with workforce training, as well as social-emotional learning in an atmosphere that generally eases them into employment. Many of the employees here have recently aged out of the foster care system. Some have experienced homelessness. Others, like Mr. Ramos, were involved in the juvenile justice system, while others are recovering from substance disorders. Indeed, many of the employees at this bistro fit the definition of what government officials and many experts today called disconnected youth. In general, the term describes teens and young adults ages 16 to 24 who are neither employed nor in education or training programs. In the United Kingdom, experts label this group with the acronym NEETS, not in employment, education, or training, or NEETS. Others use a more positive term, opportunity youth. According to researchers, these ages are a critical time in a person's life. Young people begin to form adult identities and become more independent, joining the rhythms of adult life and figuring out, as it were, how to make a living. It's a lot better than just pointlessly sitting around the house all day, not knowing what you're going to do or have any idea what the next step is, Mr. Rommel says of his restaurant job. It's good to be able to look forward and to plan on doing something. Who disconnected youth are and why they are seemingly stuck in place isn't always obvious. It makes the problem tricky to unravel, experts say. But for a sizable number of fledgling adults in the United States, a lot can go wrong. Not surprisingly, where a person grows up matters. Youth disconnection is tightly linked to neighborhood poverty, adult unemployment, and low adult educational attainment. In short, disadvantage often clusters geographically and persists across time. Risk factors can take root in unstable household situations, places where there are fewer quality educational opportunities or unreliable transportation options. Illnesses and what scholars call adverse childhood experiences can inhibit educational and employment paths, as does being brought into contact with the justice system. Disconnection, many experts say, is an outcome years in the making. Economists and social scientists began studying this phenomenon in earnest around 2010, after the Great Recession. The numbers of young people dropping out of the economy had surged to almost 6 million, or 14.7% of this age cohort, according to research by Measure of America, an initiative of the Global Network Social Science Research Council. These numbers loosely parallel the state of the economy. As the job market improves, so do disconnection rates, which stood at 10.7% in 2019. The rate climbed sharply again when COVID-19 rattled the economy. In 2023, the latest year of available data, there were an estimated 4.15 million young people, or 10.6% of this age group, considered disconnected, according to the census data analyzed in the forthcoming 2025 edition of the Measure of American Export. The rates are higher among non-white youth. Latino is 12.2%, Black is 15.9%, Native Hawaiian or Pacific Islander is 17.5%, and Native American, 22.7%. "The most dangerous thing you could have for a community is a young person without hope," says Robert Sains, president and executive director of New Ways to Work, an organization in Montebello, California, that works with private and public groups. There remain stubbornly high rates of disconnection within states such as Louisiana, Mississippi, Alaska, West Virginia, and Nevada. Many urban areas across the United States also have high rates of adrift young people that far exceed the national average. The Memphis, Tennessee metropolitan area, for example, has the worst youth disconnection rate in the nation at 17.4%. In Las Vegas, the problem remains so large that its population of 37,000 unplugged youth could fill half of a typical professional football stadium. Nearly one in seven people in this tourism-driven city are out of school and out of work, giving Las Vegas the sixth highest rate in the nation. One of the reasons fueling concerns is the long-term personal and economic costs of such disconnection. People who worked or attended school during their teens and early 20s make $38,400 more annually by their 30s than those who did not, according to a Measure of America estimate. On the flip side, Nevada officials say every disconnected youth poses an average $28,000 cost per year to taxpayers, citing the inflation-adjusted numbers from the 2012 study, The Economic Value of Opportunity Youth. The writing is on the wall, says Cecil Fielder, Strategic Initiatives Manager for Workforce Connections, a federally funded job training and placement center in Las Vegas. This is a time where we should be investing in youth programs to give them the exit ramp so they can begin adulting. If there were no limitations, what would your dream job be? The question from Rose Noriega, Outreach Manager for EmployNV Youth Hub, kicks off a program orientation inside a Las Vegas library in July. About a dozen young adults in attendance start sharing their aspirations. Author, restaurant owner, game developer, mechanic. She assures them there are no wrong answers. The EmployNV Youth Hub is a federally funded American Job Center specifically designed to help 16 to 24-year-olds in southern Nevada. Its purpose straddles career awareness and job connection. Virtual reality headsets, for instance, give these young adults a chance to explore careers in a way that written descriptions cannot. Over the past 4 years, the program has connected 1,689 youth participants to employment, given 1,087 participants paid work experiences, and helped 527 others earn a credential or diploma for completing an educational or training program. Our purpose is to make sure you get that job and keep growing, Ms. Noriega says. Two young men say they want to enter the information technology and real estate industries. Is college part of that plan? Perhaps someday, but their primary motivation right now, they say, is helping their families. 18-year-old Amire Ross, sitting at the same table, has that same desire. The newly minted high school graduate, who has work experience but has no intention of becoming disconnected, but he is temporarily out of school and without work. He, too, moved to Las Vegas toward the end of high school. To help his single mother pay bills, the teen held jobs at a skating rink and McDonald's. Mr. Ross bowed out of the workforce in February to focus on his senior year of high school and earn his diploma. His roadmap beyond high school wasn't immediately clear. Mr. Ross says he's considered becoming a firefighter or joining the military. Then a teacher mentioned plumbing, a high-demand career suited for kinesthetic learners, those who thrive with hands-on experiences and activities with physical movement. It checked a lot of boxes in his mind. I want a career that's going to last long, that I'll enjoy and be comfortable with, Mr. Ross says. Something that will require me to do physical work. That's what brings him to the EmployNV Youth Hub. He wants to connect with a plumbing trade school and get a part-time job to pay his way through the 9-month training program. He got his first job at age 15, and he now envisions one day starting his own plumbing business. Sometimes it's overwhelming, he says, about the future, but as long as I just be positive about it, I think I'll be good. The scene at this employee envy orientation exemplifies what many Las Vegas community leaders see as the most pragmatic approach to disconnected youth, exposing teens and young adults to more career options and providing a helping hand as they navigate the transition into this next life chapter. Their approach deviates slightly from the college for all messaging that dominated classroom settings for the better part of recent decades. Instead, the emerging mantra is more along the lines of college eventually. If I'm struggling because we don't have food in the refrigerator, I'm probably not going to be having a conversation about whether or not I can go to school because I don't think I can afford it, says Lisa Morris Hibbler, a managing partner at JBM Strategic Partners, a civic organization in Las Vegas that works with government agencies and nonprofits to improve communities. So we're really trying to make sure that they understand that there are lots of ways you can get there, and it doesn't have to be linear, she says. A certification program or vocational training now, an associate bachelor's degree later, associate or bachelor's degree later. That strategy could resonate in tourism-heavy Nevada, where the high school to college pathway isn't very strong. Only about 29% of the state's residents aged 25 or older have at least a bachelor's degree, according to Census Bureau estimates. That's notably lower compared with residents in neighboring states such as California, 38% with a bachelor's degree or higher, Arizona, 34%, Utah, 38%, and Idaho, 32%. If the transition from adolescence to adulthood were easy, legions of books and movies would not exist. But disconnection implies a greater struggle beyond the normal stumbling a young person may experience. In Las Vegas, the number of young people considered disconnected is being viewed as a community problem, not as an individual one. And people like Dr. Morris Hibbler, who has a PhD in public administration, have helped form the Opportunity Youth Coalition in Las Vegas. Its members represent nonprofits, the school district, social service and faith-based agencies, law enforcement, and employers, among others. Its goal is to reconnect 30,000 Nevada youth by 2030. Officials say doing so could grow the state's economy by $17 billion. As it stands, thousands of stalled teens and 20-somethings with reduced lifetime earnings would stunt the regional economy powered by residents' and visitors' discretionary spending. As more people are earning money, they are then spending that money, and the money circulates through the economy to benefit other people, says David Schmidt, the state's chief economist. I start earning a paycheck. I'm buying clothes. I am buying food. I might be paying rent. The coalition's strategy is rooted in engaging, educating, employing, and empowering withdrawn youth, and it's showing some seeds of promise. The city's current 14.8% disconnection rate has fallen from 15.6% in 2022. You hear disconnection rate and you think, oh, they're juvenile delinquents, right? They're foster youth, they're homeless youth, and so on and so forth, says Ricardo Villalobos, Chief Programs Officer for Workforce Connections. And some of them are, but interestingly, about 58% are high school graduates. The same is true nationally. More than half of disconnected youth in 2023 had a high school diploma or equivalent. Experts say there is no one-size-fits-all answer for why some young adults wind up unplugged from work and school. A variety of economic and cultural factors likely contribute. And a pandemic didn't help. The shaky economy and COVID-19 era restrictions created greater uncertainty for certain teens entering young adulthood during that period, and they remain off track. Richard Reeves, founding president of the American Institute for Boys and Men, suspects changing norms may also be at play. More young adults, especially men, are living at home longer with their parents. Those who do not contribute financially to the household may feel less pressure for economic independence. Others may be rejecting traditional career paths and aiming for entrepreneurial success or passive income streams touted on social media. It has never been that cool, Mr. Reeves says, of landing an entry-level position and working your way up, but I'm not sure that's been much less cool than it is today. In the Silver State, disconnection is more heavily concentrated among young men. 19% of men between the ages of 16 and 24 are out of work and out of school, compared with 10% of women in that age group, according to a study recently prepared for the Nevada Office of Workforce Innovation. This poses a significant threat to the state's long-term economic prosperity and social stability, the study warns. Experts caution labeling disconnection as a gender-specific channel, though, or challenge. As a whole, disconnection affects more young men in the United States, but the rate of unplugged 22 to 24-year-old women, 15.2%, is higher than men in that age range, which is 13.8%. It's definitely not a solved problem, says Kristen Lewis, director and co-founder of Measure America. The research agency releases annual reports about economic well-being, including for disconnected youth. It's still extremely concerning that so many young people are not in school and not working, she says. Inside the service center at God and Ford in Las Vegas, Angel Moreno, age 19, is helping with an oil change for a Ford F-150 Raptor. Last fall, the auto dealership launched the Gauden Technical Institute to train the next generation of auto technicians and provide a solution to a complex problem. Mr. Moreno heard about the auto technician opportunity from a friend who'd recently completed the Gauden program. Until then, the teen admits he felt directionless. He thought about becoming a sushi chef, but he didn't know how to make that happen. I was just worried about my future. Like, what am I going to do? He says. His friend was part of the first class of 5 students who completed the Institute's subsidized training program earlier this year. Now, 13 more students are enrolled, learning the skills needed to take industry certification exams and then land a full-time job. The median pay for auto technicians, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is nearly $50,000 per year. Members of the Opportunity Youth Coalition say there's hope for reconnecting adrift young people, especially since Nevada labor market data points to a mismatch between unemployment numbers and job opportunities. In July, Nevada's unemployment rate remained at 5.4%, third worst in the nation, trailing only California and Washington, D.C. The state added roughly 1,100 jobs in July, mostly concentrated in government. Mr. Schmidt, the state's chief economist, described it as a relatively stable labor market. The opportunities have been there, says Tiffany Tyler Garner, manager in the Department of Youth Development and Social Initiatives in the city of Las Vegas. The question is, are folks positioned with the skills needed to take hold of those opportunities? Auto technicians are in short supply, and the industry is facing an acute labor shortage nationwide. The nonprofit Tech Force Foundation estimates that nearly 1 million entry-level technicians in the automotive, diesel, collision, aviation, and avionics sectors will be needed between 2024 and 2028. Cesar Martinez, the Institute's Technician Career Development Manager, says he looks for kinesthetic learners who display a strong work ethic. He recruits from local high schools, but word of mouth is growing. What we're doing is serving the community, Mr. Martinez says. It's not just attacking the technician shortage, but also helping those youths that are just hanging around the house. Mr. Moreno says the hands-on, active nature of the field appealed to him, so he kept asking his friend for more information. Now, he's a student in the second class of 13 students. It's great, he says. I could just go up from here. That's the advice Mr. Martinez says he imparts to students. Do your technician training now, and in the future, consider getting an associate degree or higher. But in a service center and institute classroom, it's all about the nuts and bolts of the job. There's no better feeling, Mr. Martinez says, than being able to break something down, put it back together, take a step back and look at it and say, I did that. Addison Ripplinger, age 18, aspires to be a nail technician. For now, however, she is honing her customer service skills at the Blooming Bistro. Several years ago, in the grip of substance misuse and self-harm, Ms. Ripplinger couldn't have imagined this moment. Her transformation started at Mission High School, an education setting in Las Vegas designed for students recovering from drug or alcohol dependency. Her recovery has continued at the restaurant, where she credits Ms. Steele with mentoring her. She says guidance from her boss has taught her to value teamwork, respect authority, and bite her tongue. "I just had to learn that's not how the world works," Ms. Ripplinger says. "There's a chain of command." Now she is working on securing her driver's license as well. The presence of a trusted adult who helps young people navigate the post-childhood transition can make the difference between whether they flourish or flounder, says Ms. Lewis of Measure of America. It's even more important for young people who didn't grow up in environments where they witnessed stable career paths. They need to be able to fail safely, without terrible consequences, because they have supportive adults around them to help, she says. The Blooming Bistro is meant to be a stepping stone, co-founder Ms. Steele says. Most of its young employees don't come anywhere close to working 40 hours per week, and that's entirely fine. "We meet the youth where they're at and get them acclimated and comfortable. Then they launch into opportunities elsewhere." For Mr. Ramos, that next step is a job at Starbucks inside a Las Vegas Strip resort. Maybe down the line he will open his own restaurant or dabble in real estate. What he does know with certainty, "I deserve more opportunity and a better chance and a better life." You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg on Sun Sounds of Arizona. As I mentioned at the top of the show, Points of Progress is AWOL, and then we learned in the from the editor column that it's going to be AWOL for quite a while. So I'm going to read Progress Watch. What community looks like? Oakland volunteers haul away 25 tons of trash. This is written by Troy Aiden Sambajan, who is a staff writer. There is that paragraph why we wrote this. An effort to clean up Oakland started small. One man trying to make a park safe for a little boy to play in. Today, volunteers say the cleanups aren't meant to replace government services, but are to remind people of the importance of community. From Oakland, California. For 7 hours one Saturday, dozens of volunteers worked with rakes, shovels, and construction equipment to clear an illegal dump site on East 12th Street. They hauled away 7 trailers of trash, including discarded mattresses, a moped, and 2 mannequins. At the center of the effort was Vincent Williams, co-founder of the Urban Compassion Project, a waste cleanup group. Clad in a white disposable jumpsuit, Mr. Williams and 48 volunteers removed 25 tons of debris and spent $6,500 in equipment and hauling that day. Mr. Williams started 5 years ago with nothing but trash bags in a park he once played in as a child. He hasn't stopped since, driven by a belief that even one cleanup can matter in a city where illegal dumping has become routine. "You know how many people said this is impossible?" Or, "It's never going to stay clean. You'll never get that pile out of there," he says, watching the last trailer fill to the brim. So yeah, it's very fulfilling. Illegal dumping isn't new to Oakland, where roadside rubbish is a common sight. As volunteers clear one of its most neglected corridors, organizers pointed to the city's spotty record on enforcement. Since 2021, Oakland Public Works has issued nearly 3,000 illegal dumping citations totaling about $1.3 million. But just 11% of that has been collected. Residents say the city isn't doing enough to catch violators. One of Saturday's volunteers was District 2 Councilmember Charlene Wang. Not yet sworn in at the time, she didn't mince words as she rolled up her sleeves. "I'm not going to be diplomatic," she says, wearing an N95 mask and other protective equipment given to all volunteers. "It stinks, and we really need help." She acknowledges the city's staffing shortfalls and the community's rising frustration. "But in some ways, we are in a dire moment," she continues. "We're short-staffed in the city, and we need all the help we can get." Ms. Wang hopes that the trash cleanups will continue. "Oaklanders are resourceful people, and we find ways to get things done," she says. As a city struggles with illegal dumping, volunteers say the Urban Compassion Project's weekly efforts have become a grassroots symbol and a call for more accountability. Since its founding, the group says it has cleared more than 2,300 tons of trash, the equivalent of 1,000 garbage trucks. It's about cleaning up hearts and spirits. Mr. Williams started picking trash in 2019, shortly after his release from prison. Born and raised in Oakland, he first became homeless at age 9 and spent years cycling through foster homes, group homes, and mental health facilities. Upon his return to the city, he was shocked by the worsening conditions. One day, he met a 5-year-old boy who was living in a van with his mother. The boy couldn't play in a local park because it was strewn with trash. That moment, in a park Mr. Williams grew up in, moved him to action. He bought trash bags and protective gloves and spent 2 days cleaning the park alone. "It broke something in me," Mr. Williams recalls. "As someone who lived in this, I believe it's my responsibility, since I got out of it, to put the energy into helping other people find solutions to their living situations." He slowly built a crew of friends and homeless residents. Then, in 2021, while organizing cleanups under the name Urban Park Cleanup, he met Supriya Goles, a University of California, Berkeley graduate student. She helped expand the group's reach through social media. Together, they transformed the grassroots effort into a nonprofit co-founding the Urban Compassion Project in 2022. The community hasn't really known how they could get involved in some of the social issues that we see affecting Oakland right now, says Ms. Golis in an interview. "Instead of complaining about it, we're giving people a way to become part of the solution." The group's mission, they say, is beyond beautification. "It's about cleaning up hearts and spirits," shares Mr. Williams. "The more people get involved in their community, the less we have to rely on local city government because we're showing up for ourselves." Cleanup organizers say the city's response to their efforts has ranged from indifferent to obstructive. Also, some organizers recount promised support that never came, including one instance this past spring where the city allegedly agreed to send a garbage truck that never arrived. In a statement to the Monitor, City Communications Director Sean Maher said Oakland Public Works staff have previously spoken with Urban Compassion Project leaders to share information about the services available to the community partners, including no-cost tool loans, debris bins, and trash pickup. "I am happy to meet with UCP personally to provide clarity on our procedures and explore how we can best support them," he added. "My door is open." He noted the city's Adopt a Spot program supports more than 1,000 active groups and has helped facilitate nearly 100 one-time cleanups over the past year. Contributions of homeless people. The nonprofit doesn't just organize one-time cleanups. It works to keep sites clean by hiring homeless residents to monitor the area and alert the group if dumping resumes. The goal? Prevent future dumping and shift public perception. Mr. Williams says homeless residents are often blamed for illegal dumping. But those living on the street, like T.J. Williams, no relation, says the trash wasn't from people living there, but from outsiders. "Random citizens and businesses would come dump their trash," he says. "It really affected a lot of us because it looked like that's what we were doing, but it really wasn't." In a 2022 interview with the San Francisco Chronicle, Oakland Public Works Director Harold Duffy said most discarded trash at illegal sites came from housed residents who tossed their garbage at encampment sites rather than taking it to the dump. He noticed that the problem has escalated every year since 2017 and that homeless residents don't generate much more than normal everyday trash. Now an ambassador, T.J. Williams earns $100 a week stipend to monitor cleaned areas and report new dumping. "It's kind of not fair because we get blamed for it," he says. "If we could keep all of this clean, it would really make a difference in how we're seen." Mr. Williams says ambassadors are given a blank canvas to report any illegal activity. It ensures our streets stay clean and gives them a purpose. "What would Jesus do? I think he would clean up the trash." What began with fewer than five people now draws an average of 30 volunteers each week. The group documents its effort on social media, posting time-lapse videos of each cleanup and promoting upcoming events. John Glennonese, a recent Apple retiree, brought his own trailer and hauled more than 2,900 pounds of waste that he paid out of pocket for the dump to take. Some people go to Disneyland. I like to rent tractors, pull trailers, and go to the dump, he says. He adds that he's compelled by his faith to help. Sometimes I think, what would Jesus do? I think he would clean up the trash. First-time volunteer Vanessa Smith, a public information officer who lives in Oakland, heard about the Urban Compassion Project through Reddit. These illegal dumpings give the city a reputation it doesn't deserve, she says. But the fact that 40 of us made progress in 2 hours says a lot. Repeat volunteer Haldane Brown says it's the giving back that helps him, that keeps him coming back. My sense of Oakland after living here for 5 years is that people band together and fix it themselves, he says. It's just cool that Oakland comes together like this. Oakland-born volunteer Josiah Herbert and his wife Amina joined the cleanups after watching their neighborhood deteriorate. Mr. Herbert said he's always thinking, this is a mess. How does this happen? But then you realize we can do something to fix it, he says. Their group is working to clean a 2.4-mile stretch of East 12th Street, one of the city's worst dumping zones. Volunteers say they'll keep showing up, trailer by trailer, block by block. The goal is to do more than beautify the streets. It's to send a message. We're not here to replace city services, Mr. Williams says, but we are here to remind people what community looks like. And now for Science and Nature in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. We have one article, and here it is. It's entitled, With Cruise Ships Comes Pollution. European ports search for ways to clear the air. This is written by Doug Strzok, who's a contributor. And they have that paragraph here entitled, Why We Wrote This. Europeans have been pushing back on over-tourism. For many, the issue is more than just crowds. It's also pollution from vessels that visitors ride in on. Is there a way for port cities to have needed cruise dollars and cleaner air? From Barcelona, Spain, the 19-deck Costa Toscana eases to the dock and disgorges thousands of day trippers to souvenir shops and eateries of this old city, a 10-hour invasion of tourists that sends most locals into retreat. I don't go downtown. It's a sea of people, says Clara Galan, a tech marketing specialist in Barcelona. Some of the 5,000 passengers choose to stay aboard the ship, lounging at one of the 4 swimming pools or 13 dining rooms. For them, the Costa Toscana keeps the lights on and the engines purring all day, as many of the other huge cruise ships in the port do. Some burn heavy-duty fuel notorious for producing toxic sulfur, soot, and black particles. Others, like Costa Toscana, burn natural gas that cuts the soot but multiplies their global warming damage with methane. As the popularity of cruise ship vacations soars, so do concerns about the pollution the giant vessels create at sea and, most notably, when they stop at the coastal cities. Adjusting to air pollution. Barcelona, with its architectural marvels and bustling restaurants, is a mandatory stop for many of the more than 200 cruise ships on the Mediterranean circuit, which is second only to the Caribbean in cruising popularity. But the belching pollution frequently helps give Barcelona the distinction of having the worst air quality of any port in Europe. You can feel it. You can see it, says Xavier Laballos, who runs a school specializing in artificial intelligence in Barcelona. When you drive past the cruise ships, you see what is coming from their chimneys. You say, we should not be doing this. The European Federation for Transport and Environment said in a 2023 report that cruise liners run by Carnival Corp alone emitted 43% more sulfur oxides than all of Europe's cars. Barcelona topped the list of most polluted cities in 2022, the nonprofit group reported, saying cruise ships there emitted nearly 3 times more sulfur oxides than all the cars in the city. One local activist group, Stop Cruise Ships, says its own air measurements last fall at the cruise ship docks in Barcelona showed nitrogen oxide pollution levels 5 times higher than limits recommended by the World Health Organization. Sulfur and nitrogen oxides contribute to acid rain and acidification of the ocean and have been linked to health issues. I moved here from Amsterdam, says American Lizzie LaCour, who has lived in Barcelona for 2 years. The air pollution was a hard adjustment. I can feel it here. Searching for sustainable solutions. The Cruise Lines International Association, or CLIA, which includes 310 vessels plying the world's oceans, says in a 2025 report that its members are moving toward more efficient ways of operating and cleaner fuels. But some port cities say progress is too slow and are moving to impose restrictions of their own. Venice, for example, banned large cruise ships in 2021, though enforcement is erratic, and saw an immediate drop in air pollution. About a dozen destinations around the world have moved to impose taxes, bans, or limits on cruise ships, including Amsterdam, Santorini, Greece, Valencia, Spain, Dubrovnik, Croatia, Key West, Florida, Monterey, California, and Juneau, Alaska. Barcelona decided in July to close 2 of its 7 cruise ship terminals by 2030 and plans to bring electrical connection to all of its docks, allowing ships to shut off their engines and use power that may be more cleanly generated. Barcelona's mayor, Jaume Collboni, last September said 1.6 million annual cruise ship visitors was not sustainable. Barcelona residents have been pushing back on tourism in recent years. Activists made news in June by using water guns to squirt tourists to show they are unwelcome. The cruise industry talks of the business it brings to the port cities and says it is developing ships powered by sail, solar energy, or carbon-free fuels. But industry observers say those technologies still are far from operating at scale, especially for the large cruise ships. Tourism is vital to Barcelona and many cruise ports. However, locals say the tourists who debark for only a few hours but generally sleep and eat aboard ships are a bad deal for the city. It's a dilemma, acknowledges Regina Rodriguez Servent, an author in Barcelona who conducts small group cultural tours as she sips coffee in a cafe. The locals complain about the tourism, but we need the tourists. We need the right kind of tourists who are respectful of the culture. Daniel Pardo Rivacoba, who is active in a variety of groups fighting for a more sustainable city, criticizes the municipality and the cruise lines. More greenwashing, he says, of the cruise industry's boasts of more sustainable cruises. We want the elimination of cruise ship traffic. I mean, it's really a nonsense industry. It's absolutely unnecessary, and it harms the environment, the city, the workers, and the economy of the place. Barcelona Municipal Government, Barcelona Port Authority, Carnival, and CLIA all declined repeated requests to discuss these criticisms. Sonke Deisner at the Nature and Biodiversity Conservation Union, one of Europe's largest nonprofit environmental organizations, works to expand 2015 rules first adopted for California and Europe's Baltic and North Seas to reduce sulfur content in ship engine fuel. The regulations prompted some cruise ships to start using a lighter grade diesel fuel, he says. Others continue to use the toxic and cheap heavy fuel oil and installed scrubbers to reduce the sulfur from their exhaust. But the scrubbers are constantly washed by seawater. They just take the sulfur from the air and release it into the sea, not cleaning anything, he says from Berlin. They clean the air so humans don't breathe it, but it's toxic for a lot of water organisms. Other ships move to liquefied natural gas and advertise cruises on those vessels as environmentally friendly. But the extraction and burning of natural gas produces methane, an extremely potent greenhouse gas. The environmental concerns have not hampered the popularity of cruise tourism. Nearly 30 million passengers took cruises on CLIA memberships in 2019, according to the group's 2025 report. After a near standstill of vessels during the COVID-19 pandemic, 35 million passengers cruised last year, and the industry predicts that number will grow to 42 million in 2028. I really understand the appeal of taking a cruise, says Brian Comer, the Marine Program Director at the Washington Office of the International Council on Clean Transportation, a nonprofit research group begun in Italy in 2001. It's an all-in-one experience. You stay on board, you can eat on board, you can be entertained on board, and then you sail to all these beautiful places. But the consequences are that all of the beautiful places that you're visiting are being disproportionately harmed. A study by his group found the average cruise ship passenger is responsible for far more carbon dioxide emissions than a vacationer flying or driving or staying in hotels at the same destination. Taxes and levies to help fund research. There are ways to improve the pollution problem, says Sam Hargraves at the nonprofit Transport and Environment in Brussels. Port cities can create new renewable power supplies and require cruise ships to use them while in dock. Plugging in ports instead of running on fossil fuels when they're idling, that is something you could change quite easily. He says researchers ought to accelerate work on using carbon-free fuels. And governments might consider a tax on tourists to fund that work. You could put a levy on cruise ships, which directly goes into green technology, he says. Cruising is a luxury product. It's not a necessity. And now we find ourselves in the home forum section of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. There's one article and there's a poem, and I will read both of those. So the article, Savoring September. In the autumn of my life, I'm learning to cherish an unsung month. This is written by Johanna Wald. Recently, two friends and I discussed the best parts about entering our 60s. Among the perks we identified, getting senior discounts and caring less what others think of us, and a few days ago, I identified something else, September. September definitely gets better with each passing year. Since my earliest memories, the prospect of September each year filled me with unease. I often started fretting about it in early August. To me, August was the equivalent of one long Sunday. As the day progressed, so did the pit in my stomach. This feeling escalated throughout the month until it reached its apex on Labor Day, the day before school started. I didn't hate school, but the transition between languorous final days of August and the beginning of September was so abrupt. There was no easing into September. One day I had a little to do but wait for the ice cream truck. The next morning, the alarm goes off and the race begins. School supplies to buy, outfits to get ready, a new schedule, new teachers, and new classmates to adjust to, along with the revving up of social and extracurricular activities. When I had my own children, I experienced this phenomenon again, multiplied because both played sports. September spelled a return to early mornings, forms to fill out, school clothes to buy, schedules to review, and homework to check, along with juggling work with my kids' practices and games. It was like going from a speed of 0 to 100 without pausing at 50. I sometimes felt as if, by the time I came up for air, we were already in October. It wasn't until my kids were out of school and I was in retirement mode that I began to notice, and then appreciate, what a spectacular month September is. Hands down, it is the most glorious of the 12 months. It often brings pitch-perfect weather, blue skies, a lovely nip in the air in the mornings and evenings that might require a light jacket, and a resumption of football games to watch on Sundays. If you're fortunate enough to vacation in September, the beaches are clear, the crowds dissipate, and the prices come down. September's chef's kiss for me is the ponds. I am a swimmer, and in September, many of the area's freshwater ponds and lakes that are closed to non-residents or non-members during the summer season reopen. The gatekeepers checking stickers at the entrance are gone, and the lifeguards disappear along with the crowds, lap lanes, and rope demarcations. What is left are gorgeous, serene vistas of sparkling, dappled water, Clear blue skies, green trees with a smattering of red and orange along the shore, scattered swimmers like me, and, on a really good day, sun rays piercing through the water. I have experienced few delights equal to plunging into cool, clear waters on a warm day in late September and popping my head up to marvel the view. Of course, September is bittersweet. Darkness comes a little earlier each evening and lingers a tad longer every morning. Sometimes the nip in the morning air is downright chilly. We know that by season's end, a few football games will be played in the snow. Before long, it will be Halloween, followed by the reversal of daylight saving time, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and then the long slog of January through April. But even that knowledge can't dilute the sweetness of some of September's most enchanting days. In fact, I savor them more because I know they are fleeting. That is another lesson I am learning, to relish what I have while I have it. And for the next few weeks, I have September. And here comes that poem. It's entitled Fall in New England, and it's written by Ed Meek. It's as if someone had switched the seasons. Fall, when life blooms in a myriad of vibrant shades, a brilliant display, nature's inimitable array of diversity, the final symphony of a contrapuntal concert of color, scarlet, tangerine, copper, lemon, chartreuse, the pinnacle of the year's work, the zenith of Mother Nature's aureus. As if she's singing, can you hear me now? Do you see how beautiful I am? And finally, we've reached the Monitor's View section of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. These are articles written by the editorial staff. And there are two of them, and here I go. The first one is entitled, New York Seems Fit for a Muslim Mayor. In early November, or soon after New York City commemorates the 24th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center, voters in America's largest city might elect their first Muslim mayor. Zohran Mamdani, who easily won the Democratic primary in June, is ahead in most polls for the general election. While he has faced some anti-Muslim rhetoric during the campaign, the Big Apple's negative concerns about Islam and Muslims, common in the years after 9/11, have generally become a big meh. Mr. Mamdani's appeal to many of the city's young and Democratic voters lies mainly in its socialist promises, such as government-run food stores, identity politics, namely the desire for a leader of one's own likeness or the fear of the other, matter less. His popularity reflects the emerging power of civic and grassroots/working-class mobilization, wrote Sanjay Mishra, a political science professor at Drew University in Religion News Service. New York's probable acceptance of a Muslim mayor, while noteworthy because of 9/11, is not so startling these days. Dozens of Muslims have been elected to public office in the United States as well as in Europe. This embrace by voters helps undercut a powerful recruiting message that non-Muslims disrespect Islam, used by extremists who abuse Islamic principle for violent ends. Fear doesn't make us safer, it only makes us weaker, and a politics of fear is simply not welcome in our city, said Sadiq Khan, a Muslim who became mayor of London in 2016 and is now serving a third term. American attitudes towards Muslims began to shift upward after the 2011 Arab Spring, according to polls, but dipped last year. The high for holding favorable views was 78% in 2022, but according to polling by the University of Maryland, that declined to 64% last year, returning to 2016 levels. Yet a majority of young Democrats in the U.S., 56%, now say Muslims actually strengthen American society. That reversal of a post-9/11 stereotype might explain why Mr. Mamdani is favored to be mayor of New York. Memories of the 9/11 tragedy may live on, yet ways to prevent a similar attack require new ways of thinking. Here is the next Monitor's View article. I don't know if I'm going to be able to finish it. It's entitled, Is It Art or Science? Yes. The ancient Japanese art of paper folding is unfolding new possibilities for modern-day innovation. By combining inquiry and ingenuity with persistence and patience, a young engineering student at Brigham Young University has discovered an entirely new class of origami design. Not only does this repeating, replicatable bloom formation inspire aesthetic awe, it offers multiple applications for science and technology. Sophomore Zongyuan Wang, who learned origami as a child in Beijing, and his supervisor, Professor Larry Howell, published a discovery in a scientific journal in August. The unique pattern, made from a single sheet, can be folded flat and then expanded radially to bloom like a flower. These features make it highly deployable in compacted satellite arrays that can then expand in space or in microtechnologies and tools on Earth. Mr. Wang's work and the principles behind it, Dr. Howell says, point to an infinite number of possibilities. There are a lot of patterns out there waiting to be discovered, the article's third co-author and mathematical theorist Robert Lang concurs. As he experimented with folding and refolding, Mr. Wang told Utah's Daily Herald he felt, "Ideas come to my mind, to reality." These scientists' comments hint at what the founder of this newspaper, Mary Baker Eddy, has referred to as the inexhaustible source of creation. Moreover, Dr. Lang told the New York Times that he is struck by the sheer beauty of Mr. Wang's creations. "I would not be surprised to see that in a museum," he said, of one piece. That interplay between art and science underscores that innate curiosity and inventiveness are not constrained within traditional academic or theoretical bounds. Some scholars have pointed to a relation between emerging modes of artistic expression and scientific innovation, especially in the first half of the 20th century. They have asked, did cubism's use of multiple vantage points and geometric representations spark new ways in which physicists look at material objects? Creativity is an important tool for finding our inner artist in every discipline. Every human being is capable of cultivating it, BYU music professor Claudine Bigelow told students during a talk several years ago. Well, by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor Weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. Thank you for joining me this week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.